On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, which slow starting stars are we worried about? We'll draft those. Interview with Marlins catcher Liam Hicks. He has been incredible so far to start this season. And then we talk Volpe back up at the bigs. We talk Mike Trout, chatted with Jordan. Mike Trout showed up to the ballpark and said, "Can I talk to Jordan Schusterman?" That's not really what happened, but they did talk. Anyway, we'll talk about that now on the podcast. Have fun. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that's been starting slow for the last decade. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And it's not a slump if you always suck.
Which is unfortunately not what you can say about the baseball players we are going to discuss at the top of this show. However, before we get to our opener, we should mention that we have a special guest on this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbacast. It is the opposite of a slow starter. It is Liam Hicks of the Miami Marlins, who is off to one heck of a start to his second major league season. You'll hear our conversation with Liam later on, but before we get to Liam, we're going to do a little bit of the opposite. We're going to dive in and take a look at some of these super duper stars that are not having a good time in 2026. And this is something that I think we've touched on here and there throughout the season, but for the most part, we've been so focused on the teams that are struggling, right? The Mets and, oh, look at the Red Sox and, oh, here are the Phillies and Astros. But there are some individual players that are going through it. And it is not April 15th. In fact, it is almost May 15th. And some of these slash lines for some of the best players in the league are not pretty. However, for our opener today, we are going to put a positive spin on it and look ahead and try and project some more production. So let's get to it. It is our opener.
Cal Raleigh showered with his uniform on the other day to try and let me start that over. 3, 2, 1. Cal Raleigh showered the other day. I did too. The difference was he did it with his baseball uniform on. The big dumper has been the big slumper so far in 2026. And he is kind of the poster child of this exercise that we are going to do. Okay. Here's how this is going to work. Jordan and I have put 12 names down on a list. All 12 of these names have gotten MVP votes or made all-star games at some point in their career. These are players whose jerseys people buy. They are linchpins, cornerstones, stars and or superstars. And all of them have been disappointing to start the season. We have these 12 names on the list, and we will draft these 12 names, as we so often do with baseball players, in order of how many wins above replacement. We're going to do F4, Fangraphs War. How much F4, how valuable will they be from now, May 13th, to the end of the baseball season? These 12 names are, in no particular order, Mariners catcher Cal Raleigh, Yankees second baseman Jazz Chisholm Jr., Braves third baseman Austin Riley, Mets infielder, wink, Bo Bichette, Orioles shortstop Gunnar Henderson, Guardians outfielder Stephen Kwan, Diamondbacks second baseman Ketel Marte, Padres right fielder Fernando Tatis Jr., Rangers shortstop Corey Seager, Phillies shortstop Trey Turner, Red Sox outfielder Jaron Duran, and San Francisco Giants shortstop Willy Adames. Raleigh, Chisholm, Riley, Bichette, Henderson, Kwan, Marte, Tatis, Seager, Turner, Duran, Adames. These are the names on the board. Jordan Schusterman, I'll kick it to you.
These are not the only stars that are slumping. However, some have already begun to hit their way off of this list, most notably Rafael Devers, who was really going through it. But he has basically been the best hitter in baseball for the last week, and that alone has disqualified him. I think we wanted to get a range. I believe we have 12 different teams represented here. So a nice cross-section of the league, a nice cross-section of positions. So there are some other scuffling stars that are being spared here as part of this exercise. But
Salvador,
I think this
Perez,
is a really good mix. Yep.
Marcus Semien, we see you. We're worried about you. We'll hopefully talk about you at some point later. Jordan, to decide who gets the first pick in this exercise, which one of us do you think is struggling more so far this season?
Ooh, okay. This is good. This is a good way to think about it.
Who started slower?
I don't know. Who started slower? I mean, I feel okay. I did not feel great at the start of the season. By now, I'm feeling pretty good. I feel like I'm closer to the Devers trajectory. Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't think it was that bad in April. But, you know, it was definitely taking me a little bit of time. So, I don't know. I'll take the first pick. Sure. What do you think?
I pulled my back out again last week. So, I'm physically slower than you, I think, right now.
Okay. Yikes.
So, I'll go first.
Okay. That's fine. Go ahead. You can have the first pick. We're just going to go back and forth. We will each draft six. And I'm very curious to see how this goes. Go ahead.
So to be clear, I am drafting the player that I think is most likely to produce the most value over the rest of the season, to most likely return to their career norms. Mm-hmm. I am going to select Diamondback second baseman Ketel Marte. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you take a look at this list and you do really simple expected stuff, whether it's expected batting average, XWOBA, however nerdy you want to get. Ketel Marte is pretty much the unluckiest character that we have here. He is the eighth lowest batting average on hard hit balls in the whole sport. Now, to be clear, like I just want to explain that a little bit. Batting average on balls in play is BABIP, as it is goofily acronymed to, is basically like how are your batted balls turning into hits? Normally, the league average is around 300. And Ketel Marte, for any batted ball, and Ketel Marte's BABIP on hard hit balls, that's balls over 95, is way lower than you'd expect and feels like the type of thing that will pop back up to career norms. He's not swinging slower. He's not really chasing that much more. Like, I feel pretty good about Ketel Marte getting back to where he is, usually.
That is a totally reasonable selection. He was in my inner circle for first handful of picks. I don't think I would have taken him first, but I understand selection.
You know what? He is chasing a lot more. He is chasing a lot more.
Too bad. Already on
he
your
is
team.
Chasing a lot more.
No take backs. Ketel Marte is your number one pick. For my first selection, I am going to go ahead and select Cal Raleigh of the Seattle Mariners. Now, if he was still mired in an 0-for-30-40, if he was coming for Chris Davis's record and he hadn't, you know, finally gotten a couple of hits last night against Houston, maybe I would have been a little bit more worried. But even amidst this catastrophic season for Cal Raleigh, in which he is hitting 166, among this list of players, he is still tied for second in F4 at 0.4 already. Now, that's banked. We're talking about forward, right? So it's not like I'm getting that 0.4. We will make sure we are measuring it from here to the end of the season. However, the reason why I'm taking Cal from a ceiling, well, first of all, from a ceiling standpoint, I don't have to explain that. The guy almost won MVP last year. So that's pretty cool. But one sneaky part of Cal's season so far, and this is me playing the game, is that his defense behind the plate has been awesome. In fact, it's been better than it was last season. Hmm. And that is, I think, been a... Does it make up for the fact that he has a 67 WRC plus? No, because he's hitting at the top of the order and he's an important part of the Mariners offense. But as far as war accumulation, if he starts heating up offensively, even if he does now have quite the hole from a batting average standpoint to dig out of, and even if he does have some things at the plate that he has to figure out to find some consistency, I still think he's going to hit a bunch of home runs. And I think he's a really good catcher. And I think that that's going to put me in pretty good position. So
sure.
I do believe that Cal's is gonna figure it out. He's just too good. And I think as the only catcher on this list, I think that gives him a night because of how well he's been playing defensively. And I know that he's going to be back there.
Sure.
I think that for the purposes of this game, and I do feel confident that he's maybe probably not. I feel pretty good. He's not finishing second in MVP. I still think he's going to end up with a pretty damn good season. So Cal Raleigh is my first.
Good article this morning on MLB.com from Mike Petriello about why Cal Raleigh has been worse. Like when you're taking a look at why a player has gone backwards, right? There are various places to start. You can look at For me, the most concerning sign is always bat speed. Are you swinging slower? Are your physical traits backing up? Are you getting old? That's obviously not what's happening with Cal Raleigh. But even though he's swinging the same speed, he's late on a lot of stuff. And so that means his timing is out of whack. And when a guy's timing is out of whack, in my mind, that is much more fixable and
agreed,
more in line with just the rhythms of a baseball season, the ebbs and the flows. And so it's much easier to envision Cal getting that back at some point this season.
Yeah, and that's the last thing I'll say about him, and then you can make your second pick. I pointed this out when we mentioned it on Monday, the hitless stretch he was in. He did seem to be kind of figuring it out right before this side injury that took him out for a couple of games. But when you watched him, it was so clearly a timing thing. He was just whiffing on pitches that he was destroying last year. This was not... Yeah, the chase has sometimes been an issue with him, but he was just missing pitches that he normally crushes, and that normally is a timing issue more than anything. So I will happily take Cal Raleigh with my first pick and kick it back to you. Who you got?
I said no hemming and hawing, so I will go ahead and I will take Gunnar Henderson of the Baltimore Orioles. Gunnar is going through it. He is as frustrated as I've ever seen him. I've been around the Orioles the last couple days, and he's had some moments where he's, you know, struck out and then like banged his bat or like looked visibly frustrated. He's really struggled with right-handed breaking balls that are like down and in, middle down, changeups middle down, sliders kind of back foot from righties in a way that he hasn't in the past. To me, that's more of an approach thing. That's more of a controlling the zone thing. I don't think that Gunnar Henderson suddenly got bad at discerning between balls and strikes, right? He's chasing more, sure, but he's chasing more in the wrong counts. And so when I diagnose Gunnar Henderson, the struggling hitter, I see this as an approach problem more than anything physical or really like anything timing related with the swing. Like the swing can get out of whack when you're going bad because you try and overcorrect. But I don't think he's swinging at he's not being aggressive to the right pitches in the way that he has been in the past. You can beat Gunnar Henderson off the plate in, and you could beat him in zone away. And I think he's gotten a little too maybe pull happy with some of the pitches that are away, rolling them over, because he's not getting in an advantageous counts to drive anything on pitches that are like in his happy zones. I think that changes. This guy is still 24 years old.
He's a young man. Yes.
He turns 25 in like a month. That's bonkers. Okay. The talent is clearly still there. He looked so good during the WBC. He looks so dynamic. And I feel pretty like, I don't think Gunnar Henderson is bad now, right? I just don't believe it.
Well, that's the whole premise of this draft, right? I mean, this is the fun. Well, is all of these guys are
do you think any of the guys on this list? Okay, so like, this is actually a very interesting tangent here. We're talking about the rest of Gunnar Henderson's 2026 season, right? Neither of us believe that he's not a good baseball player anymore. Okay.
Yeah.
There are guys on this list where the question is not that, where the question is, are we done here with this? Right.
That's now, pretty we took dramatic.
Marcus Semien off the list.
Marcus Semien and Salvi off the list. Age wise, we tried to keep this from an age standpoint closer to guys in their prime. I know there's a couple guys in their 30s, but
it's a different. Two different conversations. I just want to be clear about that, right? Like because of the way we built this list, I guess you are right. It is less of we left those guys off, but this is not like is he washed, right? Now that I'm looking at the list in full, I don't think anyone on this list is cooked, is chopped, as the kids say. Right. So I will kick it back to you for the next pick.
Yeah. as we will demonstrate with our selections, some of these are more concerning than others, particularly for do we think they will actually be good anytime soon in 2026? But Gunner is a good pick, and he so far leads this group of 12 in F4 at 0.6. He's a shortstop. He'll be out there every day. I think he would have been probably my next pick, but I am happy to select Fernando Tatis Jr. with my pick.
Correct.
One of the weirdest seasons we've seen ever. Still looking for his first home run, but still playing great defense, still running the bases well. We know he's crushing the ball. And as far as just underlying stuff, it's not even close. You're taking this guy over everybody else here who, from a process standpoint, has been actively bad. Tatis is doing some things wrong in terms of elevating the baseball, in terms of certain pitches that he's attacking. It's not all bad luck. In fact, his BABIP is 327, which is crazy to think about that you can't look at that. But still, in terms of quality of contact, I know I'm getting the defense. And I do think he is going to break out of this at some point. He's not, you know, by the way, we talk about some other guys. You know, Manny Machado would have been another person we could have put on this list as an interesting, accomplished candidate. But because he's a little bit older and has been kind of trending in the wrong direction, we wanted to have Tatis as the Padres rep. And Tatis, alongside Cal Raleigh, is really the guy we've been talking about. So I think that now is when this gets interesting. These four were the four I would have taken that we've already selected. I don't know if that's the same for you. After this,
I agree.
We're kind of picking through some guys that have really been going through it. But I'll just keep it simple with Tatis and send it back to you.
If I had to pick someone on this list that could still win the MVP, non-Otani, non-Judge division, if I had to pick someone on this list who could finish top three in MVP, Tatis would be my pick, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's just bizarre. He's slugging 293. And he is hitting the ball a whole lot harder than that. So I don't know what to make of it. Maybe there is something wrong. There is a chance that there is just something broken with his swing and approach where he's still hitting it hard, but he's just not going to hit home runs this season for whatever reason. But I don't know. I still feel like the floor here is pretty high, as has been demonstrated. So I'll be happy with him as a pick. But back to you.
I'll take Trey Turner. The most interesting Trey Turner thing to me is that he's not getting any slower. Matt Gelb wrote about this at The Athletic. Now, I know when you talk about a player's value, you're usually talking about more than just foot speed, obviously. But for Turner, that's important because he does use his legs to create a lot of hits. Infield hits, turning singles into doubles, doubles into triples, etc. That has not tailed off, right? Right now, his batting average is .234. And his expected batting average is .238. So if you look at the batted ball stuff, you'd say, oh, well, he has actually been this bad. I think that this is just a streaky hitter. And I think that the physical tools are not declining yet. I have concerns about the defense going from the best in the sport last year by outs above average to below average so far this season. And talking to people around the league, the sense I get is that he has been worse, but he has not been the worst. And they expect those numbers to creep up as you get a bigger sample size. And I think that's an important thing to understand about Turner is like, because he's so streaky, he's liable to do this for a stretch of time. But over the course of a full season, I think he will, in the end, kind of work things out. Like, you remember the year, his first year in Philly, when it was so bad and like everyone had to clap for him to make him feel better or whatever. Do you know what his OPS plus was that season? Full year?
115? 115? 110. I don't know.
110.
Yeah.
110, stole 30 bases, hit 26 home runs, played shortstop.
Yeah.
Like, I think Trey Turner will be okay.
I think your point about the physical tools is spot on. The defense part is very weird, and this is going to apply to some of these other players, especially if we're thinking about accumulating WAR. In theory, that would be a positive to be playing shortstop, but I think it still is relative to some of these other guys. But you know, like an Austin Riley, who we know is at a corner. But interesting pick. Trey Turner has not drawn a walk since April 25th. Don't love that.
Me neither.
Out of our leadoff guy, I know he's had a couple 4-hit games in there, but
That not what he do though. He don't do that.
No, I know.
Trey Turner don't do
I
that.
I know. Just wanted to point it out. I don't think Trey Turner would have been my next pick, but I understand it. Okay.
Now he finished fifth in MVP last year. I forgot about that.
He was awesome.
He finished fifth in MVP last year. He was incredible.
He was awesome. Okay. With my next pick, this is risky because the other part about this is, are they going to definitely be on the field for the rest of the season? Don't love that. However, I am going to take Corey Seager here. I'm going to take Corey Seager here because his floor has been higher than all of these players, and it's not particularly close. And as weird as this stretch is for him lately, which even from a process standpoint has been concerning, there are still he's just whiffing to a ridiculous degree. He has a 27% strikeout rate when it's never been above 20, or I guess since 2017. So there's something wrong there. He's still drawing a ton of walks, and he's got a 92nd percentile barrel rate. So there are still some things underlying here that are going well, and he's just been too good for too long that I'm going to hope that this is a small sample. He is playing shortstop, not particularly well, but I still think that helps from a WAR standpoint. So it's possible he just misses 50 games and doesn't accumulate that much, but I still feel pretty good about getting Seager here.
Totally fair. Okay, I will take Bo
Halfway
Bichette.
Home. Ooh, nice. Okay.
I will take Bo Bichette. And I'm going to hit this with a that boy nice perspective. I'm gonna X out my baseball savant tab, and I'm gonna approach Bo Bichette with a different lens. I saw this man with my own two eyes on one leg take Shohei Ohtani deep to dead central in game 7 of the World Series. This is not a bad baseball player. I refuse to believe that. maybe he's not worth $8,000 million that the Mets gave him. But a man that did that in that moment with that injury, suddenly went healthy, turning into an offensive pumpkin, I'm not buying it. The underlying stuff is fine. His expected batting average is higher than his real average, like top 10 in the sport. He's still hitting the ball pretty hard. He's not really striking out. He's not walking. And most importantly, the defense has been good. Bo Bichette has been a good defensive baseball player this season. That was the biggest worry heading into the year, that him moving to third base was going to be an issue. He has been above average at third base. Now, he's had to play some shortstop recently because Lindor went down and Ronnie Mauricio went down, and we don't want to play Vidal Brujan every day. Totally get it. But I think it's fair to say that Bo Bichette that defensive move is going well. Like that is a win for the Mets. Good job, Mets. And so I just believe in the track record here. He's still only 28. That boy's still nice.
Good pick. He was definitely in the mix for me here with my next one. Gimme Jazz Chisholm.
Okay.
The only one on this list in a contract year. Mm-hmm. I know it has not been pretty. He has also been terrific defensively, which helps at an up the middle position. So if I assume he's going to be playing second base the whole year for the Yankees, I think that also supplies a floor. And I know he's streaky. I know that there's parts of his process that have been worse. I think he's really talented, and I think he will catch fire enough that, I don't know. This one's tough. This one could bite me, because maybe the contract year thing is a bad thing and it will just come crashing down on him all season long and he just piles up the strikeouts and never really gets going. But I still like him here from a ceiling pick, and I believe in Jazz. I do. And I like rooting for him. So it's a riskier one, but I'll take him here.
Yeah. I really like that the swing decisions haven't changed. Even through his struggles, Jazz would have been my next pick. Like, the chase and the walk is like pretty similar. And
which is you would above that. It's fine. It's not like elite. But it's
always
like,
been fine. Yeah, yeah. But if I said to you, Jazz is going through it, do you think that would cause him to be more aggressive? You would say, absolutely. And he hasn't been that. He has remained disciplined in not chasing. Now, is he making the correct decisions about what pitches he's swinging at in zone early in counts? I would have to dig into the numbers to see that. But I think this is a reasonable pick just because, like, again, young, athletic, in a contract year. Hopefully that doesn't swallow him. But I do think Jazz will get out of it. Okay, back to me. Back to me. Now, Jordan, now it is my
look
turn.
Look who's doing the hemming. Look who be hemming and hawing at the look same time. Hawing. Right before we started recording, Jake said to me, you better not be hemming and hawing, Jordan. I said, oh, I wouldn't dare. And look at Jake.
Here's
at Jake.
Who's
you
left.
Can hear it. You can feel it.
Here's who's left. Four names left. Austin Riley, Stephen Kwan, Jaren Duran, Willy Adames. I will take Austin Riley. I'll take Austin Riley.
Wow. Sounded real confident there.
We're at the end of this draft, so I will take Austin Riley. Why am I not? We're now at a point, right, where it's like, I am concerned. Right? Like, these are the last four names. I do have some concerns. My concern with Austin Riley is that he has not been Austin Riley now for three seasons, right? Like, yeah. He is the last time his OPS started with an 8 was 2023, I believe. That's not an elite player. He has not received MVP votes since that 2023 season. He's not been an all-star since that 2023 season. Over the last three seasons, if you add the numbers up, yes, there are injuries in there. He has been about a league average hitter over 1,000 plate appearances. Now, this is really concerning just because of how long he's under contract. For all the commitments the Braves have made, he is the one to which they are committed the longest and the most money and paid potentially over market value for, right? They have hitched their wagon to this guy the most. Now, why do I think, where are the reasons for optimism? The bat speed is still well above average and borderline elite, 84th percentile. He still hits the ball hard and hits the ball hard often. But he's not lifting it optimally. He's swinging and missing in zone. He's chasing. His defense has taken a step backward. I do think it's the type of guy who maybe could benefit more from some DH days, from getting him off his feet a little bit, where he can kind of focus on the swing and lock back in. You know what I think about Austin Riley? I don't think he'll ever be that player again that he was in 2023. But I do think he can get back to being a slightly above average player, right? Where right now he has been bad, like actively bad. If he gets back to competent and capable, I would not be shocked. If he gets back to MVP candidate, that would surprise me.
A couple things on Austin Riley, then I will make my next pick. He has a 114 WRC plus over the last 2 weeks, which is higher than any of the players in this draft. However, that comes with a 40% strikeout rate. He did homer last night. I think you mentioned 2023. What's so amazing about that, though, is that he was exactly as good in 2022 and 2021. It was this three-year stretch of excellence that just felt like, all right, that's why they paid him, you know? So, but yeah, $22 million a year through 2032. So hopefully he starts playing better baseball. Willy Adames will be my next selection. He has multi-hit games in his last three games, and he is smiling all the time, and he plays shortstop. And so that is going to be enough for me to pick him, despite a really ugly, just across the board, it has just been going real bad. And it bums me out because he's one of the nicest people in the game and someone we always root for. But maybe he's heating up. He has shown even last year it did not start great for him, the start of his Giants tenure. And he rallied and became the first Giants hitter since Barry Bonds to hit 30 homers in a season. So I still think that there is impact in here, even if he doesn't get to 30 homers this year. I will take the shortstop remaining on the board and be happy with that. So Willy Adames, welcome to the squad.
Because I got the first pick, I don't have to take Jaren Duran. I will take Stephen Kwan, another guy that we root heavy for. You've been around it. What's gone wrong?
Everything. Really going terrible for Stephen Kwan. It makes me sad. Same kind of point with Austin Riley, though. This ain't new. I know Stephen Kwan was an all-star last year, but the slump kind of began right before the all-star game. Dealt with a bit of a hand injury, but it has been really bad now for almost a full year. And it's just his skills of putting the bat on the ball are not translating to hits right now. He's also striking out more than ever, so clearly that skill is also isn't even totally intact. We know the power is never necessarily going to be there. The interesting part about this Kwan pick is that he's been playing a lot of center field, so that's new. Maybe could help from a war standpoint.
And been okay.
He's been elite. He's been okay. Yeah, he's been fine. So that helps from an overall value, but it just ain't pretty. So I hope he can figure it out for the Guardians' sake, for his sake. He's been batting leadoff still the whole time, and that's part of the problem the Guardians fans are kind of fed up with, but you know, not great. I will take Jaren Duran because I don't have a choice, and that's fine. Whatever. If I get him last, like, the Red Sox do not make any sense, and he's still a part of this team that does not make any sense. He's been playing a little bit better lately, so I think from a war standpoint, there's actually a decent chance that he does not finish last in this draft. So from that standpoint, I'm not, you know, that upset about getting him, but I mean, this is another one that after the season he had 2 years ago, it was like, oh my God, is this one of the best outfielders in baseball? Last year was better than it, because of what he was coming down from, felt disappointing, but he was still a really good player. This year, it's just been just bad. So a little bit better lately.
Out of whack.
And I will take him with my last pick.
I'm going to fly through this very quickly. This is how we ranked them via draft in order of we feel good to no bueno. Stephen Kwan, Cal Raleigh, Gunnar Henderson, Fernando Tatis Jr., Trey Turner, Corey Seager, Bo Bichette, Jazz Chisholm Jr., Austin Riley, Willy Adames, Stephen Kwan, Jaren Duran. That's our draft. That's how we feel. Disagree, agree, let us know. Jordan, before we send it to Liam Hicks, our guest, what a delight to have Liam Hicks on. Very cool story. Cool player. Out of nowhere. The Marlins are weird as hell. Liam is having a fascinating, phenomenal season. This is a guy who grew up, this makes us feel old, grew up liking our tweets, who once approached us at the stadium and said that he had been following our work for a long time. And so to have him on the pod is very weird and cool for us. So we hope you enjoy our conversation with Liam Hicks.
Before we take a quick break, wanted to let everyone know that the all-new 2026 Soccer Pick'em is here just in time for the world's biggest soccer tournament. Make picks each round, earn points, and climb the leaderboard. Play solo, create a private group with your friends, join a public group to play with other fans, or even join our Yahoo Sports group to see if you can beat us. Join at yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em. That's yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. How lucky are we to welcome in a special guest, a friend of the pod, and now a guest on the pod. It is Liam Hicks of the Miami Marlins. Liam, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Liam, we could begin in any number of places with you. You are having one heck of a season so far, tied for second in baseball and RBI, the most important statistic, famously. But I want to turn the clock back a little bit and ask you about the experience of being a Rule 5 pick. I think a lot of our listeners, like when they hear Rule 5, they're like, oh, that's interesting. I don't know the intricacies of what that exactly is. So you were drafted by Texas, traded to Detroit, and then the Marlins selected you in the Rule 5 heading into the 2025 season. And so a Rule 5 pick, if the Marlins choose, they can return you to the Tigers basically at any given time. what was that experience like of knowing that you're on a team and you're in the big leagues with this team making your debut, but you could just be on a different team literally at any moment they decide?
Yeah, definitely, you know, a little stressful. But I mean, that's the same way with anyone that's in, you know, making in the big leagues. You know, they can get sent down. Yeah. They can get sent down to AAA. But in my case, I'd be getting sent back to a different organization. So, I mean, it was a blessing, obviously. Enjoyed time in Detroit and Texas, but just being kind of wanted by the Marlins and them giving me that opportunity, it meant a lot, and obviously owe them a lot for having the trust in me and faith in me without ever even meeting me that I could be a big leaguer for them.
And then, you know, if you get traded, I imagine like when you got traded from Texas to Detroit, like you probably gave away or didn't keep a lot of your Rangers gear. When you get Rule 5, did you keep the Tigers gear just in case they returned you?
I don't know if it was like on purpose, kind of. I feel like that might be like, you know, some bad vibes if I'm just keeping it, wondering. I do just think I had a lot of it left over. And then I think this offseason was when I kind of was like, all right, probably don't need.
I'm on the Marlins. I made it.
Yeah, we can toss this. But definitely like a little bit there, you know, you know, just from the facts. I mean, not many catchers have stuck around for a whole season. Not many catchers have been picked. So, and, you know, not even catchers, but it's not like a given 100% that you'll stay the whole season. So it's definitely something in the back of your mind for sure.
At what point did you realize that you were going to make it? Like, what point during last season did you have a play or a game or a moment where you're like, oh, no. Not only am I like a big leaguer, I'm a good big leaguer, and I'm one that's going to be on this team for the entire season.
I'd say, you know, Nick Fortes got hurt early in the year, and we called up Augustine. So, and obviously he was doing really well. We were both getting to play. But in the back of my mind, I knew like Nick was going to be back in a couple weeks, and I was like, I talked to the kind of some guy, the catching coach and stuff. And I was like, we don't know what's going to happen when we got all three catchers back. So definitely in the back of my mind, that was kind of like, oh, dang, like I could go back. And then when Nick got activated, they called me into the office. Definitely a little nervous going into it, but they were like, no, we're just rolling with three catchers. Like you probably won't play as much as you were, but you're sticking around. So I was like, all right. So
you're like, okay, that's fine. Like I'll take a day here and there if I get to be in the big leagues.
Exactly. Yeah. So that definitely, once they said that and I was like, okay, they're rolling with three catchers. I figured there was a good chance I'd stick around, but then also, you know, you want to play well, you know, you play.
Yeah.
After a certain amount, it makes sense that they would keep you, but you obviously your performance is going to dictate a lot of that as well.
So, Liam, your journey has fascinated me for quite some time. And just to give people a little bit more background, I mean, the Rule 5 is certainly a key part of the story. But going back further, you know, growing up in Canada, going to Arkansas State, I mean, that already is an interesting combination of a baseball
pipeline
journey. Yeah, classic path to the major leagues. And then, you know, I remember your draft year, you kind of popping on my radar just because of the stats that pop out. And you look at Liam's statistical profile, and some of this is still very true, really low strikeout rate. You were walking way more than you were striking out. And the numbers were good. And now this year, I think a lot of people that are getting familiar with you for the first time, maybe they're seeing the stat line and they might be picturing something very different than what you are. You might say, oh man, this must be some hulking slugger who's getting up there and just swinging. So it's like, no. This is just Liam. He's just a guy. He's just a dude. He's just in there hitting the ball over the fence and never striking out and very rarely walking. I'm curious about the evolution of your offensive game, because strikeouts have never been a part of it, but previously walking a lot has been. Now, this year, part of the breakout, it seems like you found a way to be a lot more aggressive and figure out pitches that you could do damage on. Because, forgive me if I'm wrong, I don't know if like huge exit velocities have ever really been your thing necessarily, but it feels like you've had the approach now that has allowed you to get to some serious production in the major league. So talk to me about, especially this season, what you've been able to do to kind of unlock a higher level of offensive production.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's a lot there, but I'd say, yeah, last year, like looking at the numbers after the season, like they sat me down and kind of had like a player plan meeting with me for the off season and kind of showed me how good I was at making contact. So like the main thing for the off season was obviously like get more power, increase the bat speed. And then, main thing for me last year or that I wanted to work on was like pulling the baseball. I think like I knew that I had the contact ability and I knew I could hit home runs, but a lot of my outs were, you know, I was hitting fly balls to center field and like, I don't have the power that I'm going to be able to get a ball out to center. And then you see guys like, you know, Paredes, Bregman, some other guys like that, that, you know, might not have the most power, but they're optimizing it by being able to pull the ball in the air. So I spent a lot of my off season, you know, trying to pull the ball in the air better. I'd always, you know, a lot of flyouts to left, center, and like those aren't going to play in the big leagues. So just trying to be able to pull the ball better, figure out what pitches I can pull the ball on, and, you know, try and optimize when I am squaring up the ball. It's not just going to center and being an out. It's going to be down the line, maybe.
And how much of that process, you know, we all know money's made pull side in the air, right? Unless you're one of these inbox freaks like Caminero or Judge, like you're making your money by pulling the ball in the air. When you're in the cage in the lab doing stuff in the offseason, what is like the drill work that gets you to that point? Like, are you working on catching it out in front? Are you working on your swing path? Like, everyone is trying to accomplish the thing that you have accomplished in a way. So what was that process like specifically over the winter?
Yeah, well, to start off, I think first off, I've always been a guy that's like been able to go the other way with the ball pretty naturally. And I think that's where some guys maybe struggle with that part of it. But I've always been able to do that. And like that was kind of – I was a little hesitant back in the day. You know, I'd always heard like, oh, you got to pull the ball in the air. But I was like, I don't want to lose the ability to go the other way. I've found that even though
the mindset switch there almost like – you'll always have that. Like you'll always have that skill where if you have a pitch on the outer half, you can still take it the other way if you need to, right? But now you're adding something to the toolkit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that was what the Marlins kind of had to really get through to me was, you know, you don't need to punch a fastball on the outer corner in an 0-0 count the other way for a single. Like, you can take that. The bat to ball is going to be good enough. You know, if you get that with two strikes, you can do that. But, you know, wait for something in your, you know, your hot zone or whatever you want to call it that you can actually do some damage on. So, yeah, I mean, in the offseason, you know, cage work, I worked out with a lot of some good hitters. And they could tell you, like, I'm pulling the ball off the side of the cage the whole time pretty much. So, you know, back in the day when if I would do that, you might look at that as like a bad outcome. You know, you want to just hit line drives at the back of the back net the whole time. But in my mind, I'm like, if I do that, you know, it's a single, or if it stays too high, it's an out. So, you know, a top spin off the side of the net, it might not look pretty, but like that could be a double in a game. So, you know, it's kind of like a different way of thinking. It's nice to hit with, you know, in Miami and in Jupiter, they have the hit tracks. So, you can actually see, you know, you hit it off the side of the net, someone might think it's bad, but oh no, it's 103 down the line. That's at least a double, you know? So that was definitely something I worked on. Definitely catch the ball out in front, you know, backspin the ball. I've just had the tendency to topspin a lot to right in the past. So kind of just working on the path, figuring out how to backspin it, you know, doing all these different pitches and just, you know, trying to solve the problem, I guess would be a way to put it.
It is interesting how much more of it is a like a mental switch when you're doing your work than it really is anything. Like that's the first step before you make a physical adjustment, right? Like it's teaching yourself that the outcome of pulling the ball against the side of the cage is good. Whereas, right, like for our whole childhood, you're taught to not do that, right? I can imagine that was difficult to do over time, but you certainly seem to have gotten to a place where it's worked.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you hear announcers all the time when a guy just hits a single the other way, they talk about how it's such a great piece of hitting. And it's like, yeah, it is. Yeah. But, you know, a home run pulled is pretty nice piece of hitting as well. So that is something, you know, I've had to teach myself because I've always been in that boat as well. Like, yeah. I love the backside singles, just such like a nice thing to look at. But, you know, in the end, that might not be optimal for me.
Right. We always joke about the guy that does a lot for a ball club thing that announcers will say. Oh, that guy does a lot for a ball club. No one ever says that about Otani, who literally does the most for a ball club. So we, you know, exactly. Nice piece of hitting falls in that lane too. Go ahead, Jordan.
But I just think that like what's so beautiful about the season that you're having is these notions, these concepts of modern hitting, of getting the ball in the air and like improved launch angle. Like, there are a lot of old heads out there that are like, oh, well, that probably comes with a bunch more strikeouts and you're just trying to hit it over the fence. It's like, well, actually, you have one of the lowest strikeout rates in baseball. Now, that is a skill that you have already had. It is not like you are now not striking out because you are trying to pull the ball in the air. But you have managed to combine these two skills to become the hitter that you are. So that skill of putting the bat on the ball is something you've had for much longer than this kind of pull side power that you've trained yourself on. But as we mentioned, I mean, 9 home runs already this season. You had 7 your junior year at Arkansas State in the same number of games, right? Like it, and in the minors, I don't think you ever hit more than 4 or 5. Last year, we only had 6. So the power uptick is still there. But the contact has in some ways even improved compared to last year. You were making a lot of contact last year in your rookie season. But has it actually helped your entire offensive approach? Does that have more to do with pitch selection and the pitches you are swinging at that has allowed you to very rarely swing and miss in the zone, which is, to my knowledge, only happened 4 times this entire season? How has that also maybe helped or allowed you to continue to do both of those things, be an elite contact hitter and also a strong power hitter as well?
Yeah, it's really tough to say. I do think like I added like a leg kick this off season, so I'm not sure. You know, I think that might have cleaned up some mechanics or some timing or what. So that's felt really good so far this season. I just feel like I've stayed a little bit more balanced than I did last year, where I felt like, you know, last year I'd get out in front a lot on breaking balls or just you know, catch fastballs really deep. So it's really tough to say like how the contact's gone up, because I have been a little bit more aggressive this year than last year.
Mm-hmm. Swinging way more.
Yeah. So that was definitely something I wanted to do coming into the year, but you also have to like feel good. You know, once you start hitting balls and you know you can hit them, then you're going to be a little bit more aggressive. So it's tough to say how it's, that's all combined, but I'm happy for it.
Do you know your 4 in zone misses? I have them up in front of me. I'm just curious if they're in your head.
Yeah, I know the first one was a Lopez curveball, like 72 yep. mile an hour curveball.
Reynaldo. Yeah, that's a tough one, right? Like that.
Yeah.
You just got to tip your cap, the 72 mile an hour curveball in zone. Like,
no, yeah. It was like 77 earlier in the game, and he kind of dropped it down a little bit later in the game. So That was it's a good pitch. I think did I swing and miss at a changeup from Garcia?
Rico Garcia. From Rico Garcia, who yeah. is
that's a really
right now.
Yeah. He's having a year. So that changeup was really good. And then I don't know if I know the other two.
Okay, so you had a 4-seamer against Anthony Nunez with Baltimore, and then a changeup against Jonathan Bolin with the Phillies. But It's so funny that like you remember half of the individual swings and misses yeah. that you've had in the zone. Like and that's nuts.
A few of those, like the other two you mentioned, are ones that like I'm honestly like happy with. Like the Bolin one was a 3-1 yeah. changeup with I think bases loaded. So I'd
Your
rather
time to
like
swing.
It was right down the middle. Like I'm selling out for a fastball there. I'd rather swing and miss than be out in front and ground that one out to ground into a double play or something. So, and then yeah. Nunez too, I think fastball early in a count, like trying to hit a homer. So I'm, it's trying to like learn that, you know, I know there was like a lot of hype about not swinging and missing, but I was like, I don't want that to be a thing. You know, I feel like if you're not swinging and missing at all, you're not doing it. You're not trying enough or, you know,
you're not taking your shots.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's a better way to put it. You're not, you know, I'd rather swing and miss at the 3-1 changeup than just put it in play.
So I want to pivot to catching for a second, if that's okay. I am fascinated by mound visits because I'm a loser. I think they're super interesting. And I want to ask you about the first time you went out for a mound visit with Sandy last year, where you're a rookie catcher. The pitcher's a Cy Young. He's got guys on. He's in trouble. You go out to the mound. Like, what are you saying to him? Or like, what is that experience like where you're like, you believe in your skill set and you've worked with this guy in spring training. All of those things are true. But when you're walking out there and you've played in the big leagues for 2 weeks and the guy on the mound is a Cy Young, how do you kind of offer advice or feedback or support in that situation?
Yeah, that's definitely tough. I mean, it's definitely something, you know, you want him to respect you. But I think the best way to do that is to just be prepared. So, you know, if I go up there and I tell him exactly what I'm seeing, exactly what I think the next few pitches should be, how we're going to attack this guy, I think that would put him at ease a little bit more. As like, you know, you don't want to be the rookie coming up saying like, dude, I have no idea what to do. Like, what do you think? You know, that's not going to help at all. As a catcher, you got to be the most prepared on the field, obviously. You got to be there to support the pitchers. So I think just like, you know, even if you don't have the confidence, maybe fake it, you know. You gotta show the pitchers that you're prepared and that you're there for them.
So the two other catching things that I think we want to hit on before we let you go. The one is of course, as many people have made a lot of, the Marlins calling pitches from the dugout, and that could be its own podcast for sure, and your experience with it. I think one thing about that, there's two sides to that. I mean, there's a lot of sides to that. There's the, okay, this is just better strategically. We want to be calling the best pitches in the best times. But also from your responsibilities and what you have to be thinking about during a game, has that contributed at all to you being able to focus on having a 980 OPS or whatever it is? Like, how much has that taken stuff off your plate to put so much time and energy into your offensive game? Or is that just kind of a part of it now?
You know, it's tough to tell because, you know, you haven't done it. You know, even if I was calling pitches fully, could be having the same season as well. So it's tough to say. But I definitely think, you know, I think that was kind of the goal as well. Obviously, not just to call the optimal pitches, but also take something off the plates of, obviously, we got a pretty young catching group. So maybe take something off the plates and allow us to do more on that side of the ball. But it's not like we're, you know, in the cage for like an extra hour because we don't have a meeting. You know, we'll still have the meetings. I'm still hitting the same amount that I did last year. It's nothing different like that. So it's definitely,
I'm curious about that. It's not a change in your pregame workload necessarily. Like you're not spending more time with, you know, hit tracks or doing T work because you don't have to call pitches during the game.
Yeah, no, it's not different like that at all. You know, I guess the main thing would be, you know, in the past when I was with the Rangers, you know, on the off day, you do this, start doing your scouting reports on the other team. You know, now here, you know, on the off day, it's just kind of like maybe get away from baseball. You don't have to focus on that. So, you know, not saying that's good or bad. It's just something that's a little different. Obviously they have a reason for it. And, you know, I enjoy calling pitches. It's something that I've always, I think any catcher would say that they enjoy having that part of the game, but it's obviously a process they have here. And I mean, it's working out well too. I think they're having success. Pitching staff's been really good this year, and it doesn't take you completely out of the game, which is nice as well. Like a lot of people think that I'm just behind the plate receiving now doing nothing, but The pitching coaches here still really value my opinion. They still really value all of our catchers' opinions. They want to talk between innings about what's working, what we're seeing, if any hitters are moving in the box, if they're looking for certain pitches. So there's nothing.
Yep.
It's not as crazy as people think.
Yeah.
Let's finish with some ABS chat. You Woo-hoo! Have challenged the fourth most pitches behind the plate as a catcher, tied with Will Smith. The Marlins have been, I think what's been most interesting about the Marlins is that they have seemingly just only the catchers are challenging, or at least it is much more heavily tilted more towards challenging on defense. I think we just want to get at it from a human standpoint. I'm so fascinated by the interaction between the catchers and the umpires, the catchers and the hitters, those little moments when you are tapping your head. Now you've gotten kind of the feel of it. I'm sure there's some where you regret, some you feel good about, you're really proud of. But in game, in the field, like, how often are you just thinking about ABS? Like, when you have a challenge, how much has that become part of your process and something that you're thinking about from a framing standpoint, from how you're setting up? Is it something you're constantly thinking about? And how often have you had moments where are you challenging, you immediately like, oh, no, I shouldn't have done that? Or the reverse, where it's like, oh, how did I not challenge? Like, how much are you just thinking about it while you're about back there?
Definitely something you think about. We have kind of like a process in place now where, you know, there's certain, we'll kind of get something from the dugout where there's certain times in a game where it's optimal to challenge and where when it's not optimal to challenge. So we're kind of trying to follow like a process with that, where there's times where if you're going to challenge, it's got to be a full ball in the zone. You got to be 100%. And then there's times where, you know, you're allowed to challenge where you think it might just be clipping, you know, a little bit more lenient, you know, 3-2 bases loaded, he balls a pitch and you think it might be, you, that's an automatic, like you got a challenge, but maybe like an 0-1 with no one on and there's two outs and you think it's just barely clipping. Maybe we don't challenge that one, but definitely also something I've kind of, you know, that's something now that there's a bigger sample size, I know kind of where my misses behind the plate where I'm really good at receiving on one part of the zone. And then there's a part of the zone where I'm not great at receiving. So I know that pitches in that area, if an ump balls it and I'm not sure about it, there's a more than likely chance that that's going to be a strike. Yeah. So I've kind of learned that. And I've talked to some umpires about that too. I'm like, yeah, this zone, like it never gets called. So if it's there, I'm probably going to challenge. So
that's interesting because I don't know if it's still the case, but like early on in the season, the guy with the most challenges was Edgar Caro, who's the White Sox catcher, and he had the worst framing numbers in baseball last year. And so you would it makes sense that the skill of knowing what's a strike is different than actually physically framing the pitch up for the umpire, right? Like those are two distinct skills.
Yeah, 100%. I think
okay.
You know, you can get a little bit tricked when you receive a ball really well and he balls it and you're like, no, I caught that so well. That's got to be a strike. I've definitely had that happen a couple times where I've caught a ball so well that I think it's a strike and I challenge and it's two balls below the zone. I'm like, oh.
Fooled yourself.
Yeah, I tricked
it was like,
myself.
You did a good job.
And then there have been some, you know, you catch a little poorly and then you look back in the dugout and you're like, dang, I gave up on that ball. Just barely clipping. Like I got to be better.
Have you had any particularly funny interactions with umpires? I mean, we've seen some. Like we just saw last night with Travis Bezzana. He had a challenge that was wrong, and he was like, "That's on me. My bad." Like, how much back and forth is there just throughout the game of like kind of figuring out the zone? And have you had any funny interactions with umps?
Yeah, there's definitely some, you know, I'll say like that, like, you know, good call, like on some, you know, where I think it's clipping and it's not, I'm like, that's a really good call. I really thought that was there. And stuff like that, especially on those crossbody misses, like you're set up away and he pulls it in and I'm like, oh, what do you think? You know, I thought it might be there. Yeah. So I don't know about, I remember one in spring training, I backpicked and they called it a ball and then I challenged. And it was right down the middle. It was literally like right down the middle. And the ump was kind of like, ooh, ooh. And I was like, yeah. But that was in spring training, obviously. They're getting used to it. So we're getting a little grace for that.
What I've heard from people is that they're better. Like, I know this is only your second year in the bigs, but like, I've heard that the umpires this year have like stepped their game up because they're getting so much immediate feedback.
Yeah, I have heard that. And they're getting feedback from up top. So they'll have like an earpiece where they can, you know, ask.
Yeah.
Because they'll ask me, like, what do you think about that pitch that they might have balled or called a strike? And I'm like, I don't know. And he's like, all right, I'll ask about that one. So they can get feedback right away. That's great. On that, which is good. I mean, I definitely think the zone has like tightened up. You know, I don't think there's those egregious misses that maybe there were in the past, but yeah, it's been good. I think.
So my last thing for you, Rob Marcello calls the pitches for you guys. And while I think calling pitches from the dugout is cool, what about calling pitches from the press box? So my idea is one game, at some point this year, Jordan and I up in the box at Marlins Park, you give us the receiver and you let us call again. Run that up the chain and let us know, okay?
Knuckleball.
I'll mention it to them.
Thanks. Just float it, dude. Just float
we're
it.
Innovative, see what they say. So it might work.
You are. All right. Jake will get Bendix on the line.
I'll get Bendix on the horn.
Yeah.
Hey, Pete, let me get one. Let me get one. Let's come on. Let me get one.
Liam Hicks, it has been a treat watching you play baseball this season. We wish you the best of luck the rest of the way, and we look forward to seeing you again soon and maybe having you back on the show. Thanks for the time, my friend.
And welcome back to the End of Baseball Barbacast. Let's go around the league before we get out of here. Good news in Queens, New York, and it's not Mamdani filling a pothole. The New York Mets tried to fill a pothole of their own yesterday, calling up their top position player prospect, A.J. Ewing, to the major leagues. Ewing made his debut on Tuesday night against the Tigers, drew some nice walks, had a triple, showed off his speed, and a 10-2 drubbing for the Metsies. Ewing's call-up is the first real sign of President of Baseball Operations David Stearns being aggressive, pushing the issue, saying that enough is enough, that this team needs a spark, and Ewing, based upon his profile, is kind of the perfect player to provide that spark. Jordan Schusterman, tell the listeners about A.J. Ewing.
Yeah, I do think that because this is a prospect that started in Double A this season and barely played in Triple A, yeah, that shows urgency. Also, Luis Robert Jr. does not seem to be particularly close to coming back, and so who else is going to play center field is kind of where they're at.
Yeah.
But credit to A.J. Ewing for playing his way to be that best option. He was the Mets' fourth-round pick in 2023, most notably a fourth-round pick received as compensation for Jacob deGrom leaving in free agency. Those comp picks, those qualifying offers, it matters, folks, because you can get a pretty damn good player with that selection if you know what you're doing. They drafted A.J. Ewing out of an Ohio high school, Cincinnati area. Shouts out Springboro. A.J. Ewing was not on the MLB pipeline top 200 his draft year. I was texting with the GOAT, Jim Callis, last night, one of my favorite humans on the baseball internet, and he was like, yeah, we missed on that one. But A.J. Ewing was in high school, was on the showcase circuit, didn't have a great showcase, never had a lot of power. And so he had this hit tool, he had speed, but he really screamed, go to college, get stronger, go in the first round in a few years if you really can hit. He was committed to Alabama, but clearly the Mets knew, you know what, actually, we can get this kid signed. So they give him just a $675,000 bonus, which is a lot of money for a high schooler, but relative to the top high school prospects was not really anything too overwhelming. And yet he does sign, he starts his pro career, and he's just awesome. And by the end of last year, it became clear for the Mets that people that followed the system closely, hey, wait a minute. I know they have a couple like small guys that are bouncing around. They got this guy, Jet Williams, who was a first-round pick. Everyone knows him. A.J. Ewing might be better. They trade Jet Williams to Milwaukee for Freddie Peralta. They keep A.J. Ewing, and now A.J. Ewing's in the big leagues. And his debut last night was a great encapsulation of his skills, right? He's going to get on base. I love that he had a triple for his first hit, considering he had 10 triples last year, which is pretty impressive in 124.
It wasn't like a ball that he hit particularly hard either, right? We talked about this with Trey Turner earlier. Your legs can be an offensive asset beyond just stealing bases. And I think that is like as true with Ewing as it is really with like any other player in the sport. If he goes yard 10 times over the rest of the season in the big leagues, that would be shocking, right? That would be very impressive, right?
Yeah.
He could go yard 3 times. He hit a ball close to the wall last night. But like he's here to turn doubles into triples, turn singles into doubles, and that's where the extra base hits are going to come.
Yeah.
If you want to compare him to someone, I threw out Adam Eaton, Shane Victorino, like if it goes wrong, Daniel Nava. Okay. Like it is rare for a guy to have an OPS over 800 with this little home run power. Like he hit 3 home runs in the minors last year and had an OPS over 800. Like that's hard to do.
Yeah.
But it seems replicable because of how he's getting to those numbers, and that is his speed. Fun player. Like this is a player that Mets fans are really gonna like watching. It is yet another sign that despite the big league woe, there's a lot in this organization that is going right. And I think it is important to remember that David Stearns, for all the flack he's received and the mistakes that he definitely has made, and he should be judged by the results at the big league level, no doubt. This is only year 3 of his tenure. And the minor league development stuff takes time. It takes time. And I think that this organization is doing a lot right in terms of drafting and developing. And Ewing with Carson Benj and Nolan McClain is evidence of that.
Yeah. And, you know, that 23 draft was, I guess, right before Stearns got there. But I agree. I think that from a development standpoint, and then from being willing to be aggressive and promote him is pretty cool. He's only 21, turns 22 in August, and stole a base last 70 steals is the other big thing last night, which I think was top 10 in the minors last year. So, for those of you who are like, well, of course 70 steals is top 10. Yeah, well, there were some guys that stole a lot of bases in the minors last season. So
it's very easy to steal bases in the minors.
And it's easier to steal him in the majors, and I expect him to make an impact. I don't expect him to steal 70 in the majors, but that is still a part of – for the Mets offense right now, you're just desperate for anything that resembles a spark, that resembles some sort of pressure on the opponent. And so I think A.J. Ewing can provide that. And it does create an interesting dynamic with Luis Robert Jr. also. Now, A.J. Ewing has bounced around the field. He's played some second base, but – I'm curious if he can run with this. You know, where do they fit him in the lineup? What does that mean for Robert? Stuff like that. This is not a problem right now. They just need to climb their way back to 500. But that is a roster dynamic that I'm looking forward to if AJ Ewing can continue to have success. One other thing from last night we wanted to mention before we talk about some things we saw with our own two eyes. Paul Skeens took another no-hitter deep into an outing. What was this, like the third or fourth time this year he had a no-hitter through 5 or 6? I mean, it was the perfect recipe. You know, Rockies on the road. I was ready. I was ready to write about Paul Skeens throwing a no-hitter last night. But Mickey Moniak said not so fast. O'Neill Cruz's diving attempt was not quite there. So Mickey Mo breaks it up. But Paul Skeens, another marvelous outing. His ERA is back under 2, which is pretty cool considering his ERA was 63 on opening day. I don't remember what the exact number was after allowing 5 earned whatever. I know O'Neill Cruz
67.50
really did not help him out. 67.50 on opening day after allowing 5 runs and recording 2 outs. But been the best pitcher in baseball since then. So, yeah.
On opening day, he allowed 5 runs in 2/3 of an inning.
2 outs. Yeah.
Since then,
he's allowed 6, right?
2 outs. Since then, he's allowed 6 runs in 49 1/3.
Honestly, I think what happened on opening day might have been the best thing. Like, that was perfect. Exactly what needed to happen.
This
for
is
Paul Skeens to be like, okay, never again.
2 walks that day, 5 walks since.
Yeah, I mean, he's, it's like, yes. Again, I said this when we did our early awards picks, and that was 2 weeks ago. I was like, still picking Skeens. Sorry, Otani.
Yeah.
Because especially from an inning standpoint, he's going to, what was so encouraging last night was just the efficiency. I mean, I think he only had 60 pitches through six innings, and that's why I thought, oh, yeah, it's happening, because they're going to leave him in there. And
he's gone eight done,
but
in his last two starts.
I don't know if this is a bold prediction. I guess it is, because it's 2026. I think he's got multiple complete games in him this season.
Mm.
And I know that doesn't sound like a hot take, but again, there were what, five? How many complete games last year? Like five? there were for the whole season, so something like that. So I think he's going to do it, because he knows exactly what he needs to do to get through innings quickly. And if he wanted to strike out 15 a game, he probably could. But he just knows that that's not going to allow him to be in the game longer. So he's just going after soft contact. And he is the best, especially with Tarek Skubal rehabbing his loose body. Paul Skeens is the best pitcher in the world. That's what it is right now.
I love that Paul Skeens is at 50 innings exactly over nine starts. Cam Schlittler is at 53 over nine starts. And Paul Skeens had an outing where he got two outs. So, like, he is going to build, like, he's working against that, and he will eventually get his innings to where they need to be. All right, from things we didn't see to things we did see, a little field report. Jordan, you went to the Progressive Field, the Prog, as people call it, the Jake, in Cleveland last night. Everyone calls it that. No one calls it that. Last night, to talk to Mike Trout. How's Mike Trout?
Mike Trout's pretty good. He is having a good season.
What was that? First of all, what was that? Like, this was your first time, like, sitting down and talking to Mike Trout. Be like, hi, Mike. I'm Jordan.
Yeah. Yep.
One-on-one.
Yep.
How are you, Mike Trout?
Yep. Yeah.
How was that?
You know, what
that like?
This wasn't some, you know, hour-long sit-down or anything. He gave me a few minutes, took some time out of his batting cage session.
Thanks for taking some time. And
yeah, then that's exactly what I told him. shouts out to Angels PR for helping me out. But yeah, I just wanted to check in on Mike Trout, who's playing center field every day, and OPS back over 900, where it belongs, but where it has not been since 2022. And there were really two things I kind of wanted to just talk to him about. Mostly what was the process of getting back to where he wanted to be after last season, where he was healthy. He did play a lot, but it was not at the level that he wanted. And it's the thing that he just keeps mentioning, which is that he just wanted to get back to being a full baseball player. And it really does seem meaning playing center field every day. And it really does seem like, from a mental standpoint and from just how he was approaching the game, being this DH and occasional right fielder did not make Mike Trout feel like Mike Trout. And so whether it's the way he talks about it, whether it's the way Kurt Suzuki talks about it, and it seems like as soon as Kurt Suzuki got hired, he was just like, hey, Mike, you want to go back in center field? And Mike Trout's like, hell yeah, I do. That's where I should be. So if his body can hold on to it, I think that you're kind of seeing why that's the case. So that was cool. And then the other nugget that I kind of wanted to ask him about, just as part of the Trout lore that I know is not something that I've really seen talked about as much, but is obviously up our alley, is where he was committed to college. This is just ECU, a bit of baseball, right? Trivia. Yeah. So East Carolina, and you know, this is something that I love talking to players about anyway, but in Trout's case, it's just this great what if. Not that it was ever likely he was going to end up at East Carolina, but the connection that I found that kind of fell into my lap is the fact that Guardians reliever Sean Armstrong, who's currently on the injured list, was at ECU when Mike Trout committed there and was there on his official visit. Mike Trout went down to Greenville, I guess his senior year, just to be like, all right, I'm committed here. And he just remembers the coach at the time, Billy Godwin. Weirdly, no relation to current head coach Cliff Godwin. So strange. Their coach before was named Billy Godwin.
Sure.
Anyway, Sean Armstrong just told me this funny thing. He was basically like, yeah, Billy Godwin said, yeah, he's not coming here. I mean, it's not happening. But at least we could get him on campus. By the time he was getting to his senior year, it was very clear this guy was going to be a high pick. And there's so much else with the draft, like Trout lore, that there has been written about plenty, but I did want to ask Trout about the ECU connection. And yeah, he told me that Billy Goblin saw him in eighth grade and was like, yep, that's the best player I've seen at that age ever. And told him as a freshman, you're going to be our center fielder. Mike Trout said, sounds good. And he kept with that commitment all the way through high school, even though I'm sure plenty of other schools were like, hey, Mike Trout, come play for us. He said, nope. And surprise, surprise, loyalty, a theme in Mike Trout's career. That has been true from the very beginning, and it remains true today, though I know many people want him to be traded. That is a conversation that I have no interest in having right now, nor will I be writing about. But I'm sure come deadline time when the Angels are in last place, we will have the conversation again, and I can give my full thoughts about that. But this was really just to check in with an all-time great, and I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to do that, and I'm looking forward to writing about it this week.
I saw Anthony Volpe come back. Hall of Famer?
New Jersey baseball.
Maybe.
New Jersey baseball, baby.
New Jersey baseball.
North Jersey.
Very different.
Very different
New Jersey. Mike Trout and Anthony Volpe are both from New Jersey is like saying that like it's just whatever. I couldn't come up with an analogy. Sometimes you swing and miss.
It's okay.
It's okay to take hacks. Anthony Volpe is back. That's because Yankees starting shortstop Jose Caballero has gone on the IL, 10-day IL with a fractured right middle finger, I believe. So, but the Yankees gave the Orioles the bird on Tuesday. No. Caballero on the IL, and so Volpe is back up from AAA. Volpe, who was the Yankees starting shortstop for the last three seasons, got hurt last year, played through it, had offseason shoulder surgery, started the year delayed, did a rehab stint, and then was optioned to the minor leagues on May 3rd with Caballero kind of wrestling the starting role away at the big league level. But now Volpe's back. And it was just so interesting seeing the contrast because both Volpe and Caballero talked last night after the game. And, you know, Volpe is, as a childhood Yankee fan, in the mold of like Jeter, Judge, say nothing, say all the right things, reveal zero, you know, I'm here to win. I'm here to be a part of the team. I'm whatever. Caballero is not that. Caballero is like, I'm going to be back in 10 days. I love play. Like he's just offering so much more panache and energy and zest and like seems to be enjoying himself in a way that Volpe, even when things were going all right, like he had some of the childlike joy, but it wasn't the same swagger that Caballero's been playing with. And that moment was really highlighted when, as Caballero's leaving the locker room yesterday, he just says out loud to nobody in particular, nine more days, guys, as in nine more days left until he's off the IL. And to me, it might as well have been saying it to Volpe. Like, nine more days, Anthony.
Pretty much.
Yeah, 9 days here, brother. And it's back to Scranton.
Oof. And I don't... So Volpe didn't get to the ballpark until very late yesterday, so he did not start. And game I believe time. He didn't get into the game. So they still have, you know, they have Max Schumann, who's just kind of a consummate bench player, but he can handle shortstop. I assume Volpe is going to start over these next 9 days.
He's going to be the everyday player. He is the everyday shortstop. Yeah. Aaron Boone said that during pregame yesterday. He's the everyday shortstop for the Yankees.
But it sure sounds also like said, no matter what. Yeah.
Boone also said that when Caballero's back, it'll be Caballero, right? And so I think that is very, very interesting. What does that mean for Volpe? Like, if Volpe rakes here, does he stick around and they platoon the... They can't platoon, they're both righties. But, like, they stick around and they use both of them. Like, do we see maybe some of them play some second base? If Jazz is struggling against lefties and is maybe a platoon player...
Or third
base.
Do we
see them working at third? What do you say?
Yeah. Third base, yeah.
Third base, like, it's not like there are ways to do this. There are ways to do this. I think they want Volpe playing every day, so we'll see how things play out. And then just one quick moment that stuck in my mind, and I want to be very clear, like, I'm not trying to make anything more of this than it sounds. So, like, last night, Volpe's not in the room. He's probably showering or working out or something. And Caballero's in there getting dressed, right? And he's, like, putting his shoes on, and he, like, goes to tie his shoe, and he's, like, walking over to a different part of the clubhouse. And he's like in front of Volpe's locker and he like puts his foot up on Volpe's chair to like tie his shoe. And it was just this moment where like I took a mental image of him right with his leg up on Volpe's chair, like with Volpe's nameplate over it, like looking like Johnny Walker with a leg in the air. Like, it, again, that happens all the time. Guys sit in other guys' chairs all the time. It is, was not Caballero disrespecting Volpe, but just that mental image of it in to like stuck with me, right? And will stick with me.
Yeah, and regardless of Volpe's journey and the ups and downs, just Caballero's story is, I mean, that dude has grinded his way to be the shortstop of the New York Yankees in a way that
it's amazing.
You ever I mean, it's an awesome, this is his third or fourth organization. I mean, he was drafted by Tampa, or sorry, drafted by Arizona, traded to the Mariners, traded to Tampa, and now the shortstop for the New York Yankees. And from Panama, plays junior college. He's a junior college star. And yeah, he's a fascinating personality, and then obviously a fascinating player as well. And as the Yankees, who we believe
we'll be
are
talking
really good,
a lot more about this, him.
Yep. We certainly will be. So, but he's earned it. And I think Aaron Boone has made that clear that he's earned it, and Aaron Boone loves him. And I'm not surprised that he wants to keep playing him. So this weird injury just makes the story more compelling, but it probably doesn't really change things that much, as you say. Thank you to Liam Hicks for joining us on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. Thank you to Zach Benson of the Buffalo Sabres, who tied up the series last night against the Montreal Canadiens. Let's go Birds, baby. We are so back. Shouts out to UPL as well. What a showing from him. You can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com, and we will be back on Friday. See you guys.